Hello, Dr. Gomez here from the University of Texas Health at San Antonio. Today, for episode 3 of the MSK Radiology Genie podcast, we're going to talk about the imaging of osteomyelitis. Hello to everybody. Today, we're going to talk about the imaging of osteomyelitis, and we're going to revise the terms following the guidelines from the Society of Skeletal Radiology white paper on musculoskeletal infections. We are not going to talk about soft tissue infection, just bone infections. The white paper was done by a lot of great radiologists, and the moderator was Dr. Morrison from Jefferson. So as you know, osteomyelitis is infection of the medullary cavity of the bone. I think in the cortex, we call it osteitis, and you can have infection of the cortex, but the term osteomyelitis is just infection of the bone marrow, or the central part of the bone, the medullary cavity. If it extends into the joint, then we call it septic arthritis, and of course, it can extend into the soft tissues. Most of the infections of the bone, the overwhelming majority, are caused by Staphylococcus aureus in almost 80% of the cases. And other organisms that you might want to remember for the test is the Pseudomonas and Klebsiella, which are very common on IVDA, intravenous drug abusers. And always remember the Salmonella, which are very common in sickle cell patients. Also in Europe and the Middle East, Kinjela kinjae is very common cause of osteomyelitis. But if I were to remember, I will remember Staphylococcus as the most common, Salmonella for sickle cells, and Pseudomonas and Klebsiella for IVDA patients. So osteomyelitis, we divide it in terms of the route of spread, if it's acute, subacute, or chronic. So we're going to discuss that real quick. In terms of the routes of disease spread, the most common overall will be hematogenous, and that is very common in children. And usually you see it in septic patients. In the adults, you see discitis osteomyelitis very commonly. The other one is contiguous spread, and that is when you have an ulcer, and diabetic patients or paralyzed patients, and you have infection coming from the outside of the body through the skin, through the soft tissues, through the cortex, and into the bone. And then the last and least common is direct implantation, which is usually iatrogenic, an implementation of hardware or procedures, or any puncture wound of that sort that implements the bacteria or the organism into the body. In terms of hematogenous spread, we have bacteria or pathogens within the bloodstream, and they get deposited within the bone. This is most common in the metaphysis or the metaphyseal equivalent, and that is because in the metaphysis, we have this large supply of very slow flowing blood, and also at this capillaries, the endothelial lining, it has this little hole, so it's not continuous, and this discontinuity has some leak of blood into the metaphysis, and there can go the organism. That's why most of the hematogenous spread is seen in the metaphysis. This is seen more common in children, hematogenous osteomyelitis. In adults, it's usually a contiguous spread. There's a bimodal distribution in terms of the location related to blood supplies of the metaphysis. Remember that infants less than 18 months, you have those transepiphyseal vessels, you know, vessels that go through the metaphysis, through the growth plates, and into the epiphysis. And infections in the infants start in the metaphysis, but they usually extend into the joint. Same as in the adults, when the growth plate closes. When it closes, you don't have those that barrier of the growth plate, and infection can go from the metaphysis to the epiphysis very easily. But in children, when they have open growth plates, this serves as a barrier, and having no transepiphyseal vessels serves as a block. That's why when you have hematogenous osteomyelitis in the metaphysis in children, you often see that the infection goes into the superiosteal space instead of going through the growth plate, which is important because in children we have this big superiosteal abscesses that we can also see in ultrasound because the periosteum is very thin. And it's because the open growth plate blocks the progression of disease, and the increased pressure in the bone wants to get out somewhere, and it just breaks the cortex and it goes into the superiosteal space. The second route of spread is contiguous spread, and this is most common in adults. Hematogenous spread is most common in pediatric patients, but contiguous spread is most common in adults, as we see when we have a deficient immune response, such as in diabetic or vascular insufficiency, and you get ulcerations of the skin, cellulitis, and it extends into the bone. So very common in diabetic patient, and the foot, diabetic foot, and osteomyelitis is very common, and that is the classic example of contiguous spread. One thing that came out in the SSR, a white paper that they're recommending, is that be careful in vascular insufficiency, because in patients with limited blood supplies to the bone marrow, the fat cells, the T1 signal intensity may be compromised. So you have to be a little bit careful with that when evaluating osteomyelitis in patients with severe vascular compromise. So we mostly use radiograph, CT, and MRI to evaluate for osteomyelitis. As you know, radiographs are good, but in the very early stages of osteomyelitis, less than 2 weeks, the acute phase, most of the time you don't see anything. You can see edema on MRI, increased T2 signal intensity, which will be bright in fluid-sensitive images, as early as 1 to 2 days of the start of the infection, but on radiographs, you won't see much. Same as CT, because you don't see really bone marrow edema in conventional classic CT scan. However, when you start having some trabecular or cortical destruction or periosteal reaction, CT is really good. In fact, the SSR white paper recommends CT scan examination for a sequestrum, which is a dislodged dead piece of bone we're going to describe a little later, because it's just cortical bone, and you can see it merix sclerotic cortical bone, which you can see it very well on the CT scan. So MRI, very sensitive, but the thing that you have to remember is that edema in the bone, which is what you see in osteomyelitis, is very nonspecific. And even the SSR white paper is saying, really, for the evaluation of osteomyelitis, the most important thing are the secondary features. What are you going to see? Do you see an abscess? Do you see a tract? And all these things that can let you know that you have osteomyelitis, because really the finding of bone marrow edema is really nonspecific at all. So the most important thing to remember for evaluation of osteomyelitis in MRI is how you're going to correlate with the second feature that you see on the imaging study. So acute osteomyelitis is osteomyelitis that have symptoms that have lasted less than 2 weeks. You see edema on MRI, but on CT, on radiograph, is probably going to be just negative. And this is something we're going to have to remember, that classically, the diagnosis of osteomyelitis is made on MRI and is defined as low T1 signal intensity that usually obviously would have some increased T2 signal intensity because of edema. But sometimes we have some edema on the T2 and then no findings on the T1 sequences, and that is debatable, and that's one of the things that we're going to discuss later for the SSRY paper. But you should remember that the diagnosis of osteomyelitis, just like a fracture, is made with the T1 sequences when you have low T1 signal intensity, which means that you have marrow replacement. So in acute osteomyelitis, you can have early necrosis, early abscess. And something I want to talk in terms of early abscess that was discussed in the SSR white paper is the phlegmon versus abscess. Phlegmon is just like an inflammatory mass that is not well defined, and we call it a pre-abscess. It's something that most likely is going to end up in an abscess. And the recommended term in the white paper is necrotizing soft tissue infection. So remember that, necrotizing soft tissue infection instead of using phlegmon. After acute osteomyelitis, of course, it turns into subacute osteomyelitis, and this is what we know as a Brody's abscess. I know you've heard this term before, Brody's abscess, and it's usually an abscess in the metaphysis of the bone, and we see it most commonly in children, not exclusively in children, but we see it a lot in children because of the hematogenous spread. In radiograph and CT, we should see a lucent lesion with very thick sclerotic borders, because it is an active lesion, right? It is an active infection, but the bone has some type of time to make a response with the osteoblastic activity, right? The osteoclastic activity, which is activated by the increased vascularity, eats the bone and creates this lucent lesion, and the osteoblastic activity deposits some bone around it. and the border is thick because the lesion is active. If the lesion was inactive completely, like let's say a non-ossifying fibroma, that sclerotic border would have been very thin, sclerotic but very thin. And something very important when we say in terms of secondary findings suggested by the SSRY paper in terms of diagnosing osteomyelitis is the MRI findings of a Brody's abscess. And it's describing the four layers from center to periphery. So if you have this abscess in the bone, the center of the abscess or the lesion is going to be low T1 and high T2 signal intensity with no enhancement because this is pus. So the pus is almost behaves like fluid, so high T2, low T1, and no enhancement. And then surrounding that center region of pus is that inner ring of granulation tissue. And this shows intermediate to high T1, usually high, low T2, and it has diffuse enhancement because this is granulation tissue around the abscess. And we know this as the penumbra sign or the rim sign. And this is kind of very specific for subacute osteomyelitis. And when you see this, it helps you, help you in your differential diagnosis. Remember that in right, you have a lesion in the metaphysis of a kid, and there's always the problem of, okay, we have to exclude some kind of tumor like osteosarcoma, and because they all look like bone marrow edema, it becomes a problem. So this is one of the very, very, very good secondary findings, the penumbra sign, to differentiate some more worrisome lesion like osteosarcoma from osteomyelitis. If you see this penumbra sign, which is this, remember, granulation tissue and the second ring or layer in the Brody's abscess. Then the outer ring, if you think about it, is fibrosis. So after the granulation tissue, you have this region of fibrosis, and you know fibrosis shows low T1 and low T2 signal intensity. So it will be a thin ring of fibrosis. And then the last ring or layer will be all this edema around the lesion, which is a halo. It's just very thick bone marrow edema, and of course that will show high T2 and low T1 signal intensity. So remember Brody's abscess, and if you're going to remember one of these things, is the penumbra sign, which is the granulation tissue shows peripheral to the center region of pus. And the Brody's abscess, once it's an abscess, you can see both in X-ray, CT, and MRI, and mostly you can see any part of the body. So moving on from subacute osteomyelitis / Brody's abscess, we're going to chronic osteomyelitis. And this happens really because as the pressure within the bone starts increasing, you get vascular compromise, and then you start having necrosis and dead tissue. There are some imaging secondary findings in chronic osteomyelitis that are really important to remember and that help us make this diagnosis of chronic osteomyelitis. So in terms of chronic osteomyelitis, and the timeline is usually infection longer than 6 weeks or more, around 6 weeks, and it really results from osteonecrosis. So what happens is that you have this Brody's abscess within the bone, and suddenly it keeps growing and growing, the infection. And sometimes this infection grows and around the bone and happens to have a piece of dead bone, necrotic bone, that is devascularized, and it gets left behind inside this pool of abscess. And this is called sequestrum, which is a devascularized and protected piece of bone that is within this abscess. And remember, this antibiotics and the endogenous immune system cannot get to this piece of dead bone, and it's really, really, really hard to treat. That's why most of the time it ends up in the surgical treatment when they do surgery, take this thing out, and put antibiotic beads. But this sequestrum is nonspecific, and it can also be seen in lymphoma, MFH, metastasis, and others. And this is part of the SSRY paper. And that it's just not specific, but you should try to identify it, especially if you see the cloaca and involucrum that we're going to talk about it. And remember, the CT is most useful for evaluating the sequestrum. So when you have this dead piece of bone, what the bone does is that it starts creating new bone around it. And that formation of new bone that looks like periosteal reaction is called the involucrum. And the involucrum is just this formation of bone around this piece of dead bone that has been left behind. And it, in terms of the involucrum, remember that it should always have a sequestrum. That's part of what the SSR recommends. So try not to be calling, well, there's an involucrum there because if you don't see a sequestrum, because it has to have a sequestrum. So this piece of dead bone have this bone formation around it, and that's called the involucrum. And also it's a very good finding that we want to see to be able to make this diagnosis of infection of the bone that is chronic. And then so you have this abscess in the bone, and this abscess just wants to grow. And what it wants to do, like any abscess in the body, it just wants to decompress, right? You have an abscess, and it gets consulted to interventional radiology, and they put they aspirate and leave a drainage because you decompress and you just get, patient gets better. You're helping the immune system get rid of this infection. So in the bone, because of course the bone is hard, it tries to get out. So what it does is this infection creates a tract within the bone to get outside the bone through the cortex. And this tract or excavation is called the cloaca. And that's the way that the bone decompresses the abscess, and then you get that pus outside the bone into the soft tissue. But important to know is that the cloaca is extension of infection. It happens slowly, and it's not a pathological fracture, which is one of the things that the SSRY paper wants you to differentiate, because of course, when you have infection, the bone gets weakened and you can have a pathological fracture just because the bone is not normal. It may be difficult to distinguish between a pathologic fracture, so the white paper recommends that you only use cloaca, the term cloaca, a tract through the bone, only when there is excavation of the bone and the borders are sclerotic. So what happens? Once this infection is in the soft tissues, of course, you're going to get cellulitis and an abscess in the soft tissues around the cortex of the bone. And what happens when this abscess in the soft tissues? Well, you know something? It wants to get out of the soft tissue. So what it's going to do is going to create a tract through the soft tissues into the skin and outside the body to decompress. And this is called a sinus tract. So remember, Brody's abscess creates an abscess. Sometimes this abscess goes around the bone. It dislodges a piece of dead bone inside the abscess called a sequestrum, better seen on CT scan, and hard to treat because antibiotics don't get there because there's no blood supply. Then this pus wants to get out of the bone. It creates a tract through the bone into the cortex and into the soft tissues, and that is called a cloaca, which may be hard to distinguish from a pathological fracture. So we have to see that excavation of well-defined sclerotic borders. Then it gets into the soft tissues, creates an inflammation of the soft tissues, an abscess, and then in the soft tissues wants to get out of the soft tissues, and it creates a sinus tract. And one thing to remember for the test is that the cloaca and the sinus tract, they create a lot of inflammation of the surrounding soft tissues, and you can get complicated by squamous cell carcinoma as anywhere else in the body. When you have tissue that is chronically inflamed, you have a risk of degenerating into a squamous cell carcinoma. And the last one, the involucrum, which is this bone formation around this dead bone called the sequestrum. Just remember that you should always say involucrum when you actually have a sequestrum. Okay, so now we're going to talk about pedal osteomyelitis or osteomyelitis of the foot. And this is just important because it happens a lot in diabetic patients, and diabetic patients develop neuropathic arthropathy or Charcot arthropathy. And in Charcot arthropathy, you have a lot of bone destruction, a lot of bone production, disorganization, dislocation, midfoot collapse, rocker bottom deformity, all those things that we see in neuropathic arthropathy. It's just a destructive arthropathy. And the problem with that is that if you have a lot of active neuropathic arthropathy and you do an MRI, what are you going to see? Bone edema, bone destruction, fragmentation, and all these things are very similar to what you see in osteomyelitis. So it is almost impossible to differentiate osteomyelitis from active neuropathic arthropathy. So the recommendation is that you only do imaging in neuropathic arthropathy or patient with a diabetic foot if you actually have an ulcer. When you have an ulcer, what you want to see is that ulcer extending into the bone, and then that bone having changes of osteomyelitis with decreased T1 signal intensity and replacement of the bone marrow. So that's how you diagnose osteomyelitis in a diabetic foot. So remember, if somebody asks you, hey, I have this diabetic patient that has a lot of inflammation of the foot and swelling but no ulcer, probably MRI is not going to be of any help because you won't be able to differentiate what are the changes of neuropathic arthropathy and bone destruction versus the changes of osteomyelitis and bone destruction. So look for that ulcer. Hopefully it extends into the bone or to the vicinity of the bone. And then you can see the changes in the bone marrow with decreased T1 signal intensity to make this diagnosis. Finally, but most importantly, we're going to describe the term osteitis that we use a lot, and then the use of biopsies in infection. So this is the basic topic of the SSR white paper, is the term osteitis. You know, osteitis classically, it's just inflammation of the cortex, right? You have inflammation of the cortex and we call that osteitis. As we said before, osteomyelitis is infection of the bone marrow. Osteitis is inflammation of the cortex. Now, we have come to describe this as these regions of subcortical increased T2 signal intensity or edema that do not correspond to an abnormality on T1. And because historically we have said, look, you know, for you to have osteomyelitis, you got to have changes on T1, decreased T1 signal intensity, because that means that the bone marrow has been replaced. There is pus, dead tissue, and that is when you say, okay, there is osteomyelitis, because we have adopted this term called reactive edema, right? We have reactive edema of the bone, and it just means like, okay, we have this edema in the bone, maybe related to a lot of chronic vascular insufficiency and edema, but it has no T1 abnormality, so it's just edema. There is no replacement of the bone marrow, so there cannot be infection. But now we know there's a lot of people who have done research that probably that region of subcortical edema that shows high T2 but no T1 signal intensity in the context of a lot of soft tissue inflammation is probably early osteomyelitis. And we've been calling it like, well, you know, there's no osteomyelitis, just reactive edema. But it, in most cases, has been proven to be early osteomyelitis. So now the SSR white paper is recommending you to avoid using the term osteitis and instead use the term high or low likelihood of osteomyelitis. And this is what I would do, right? If I have an obvious osteomyelitis of one, let's say the hallux metatarsal bone, and the first toe, right? And then the second toe, and it's, of course, in the first toe, it's associated to a big ulcer, a lot of soft tissue infection and abscess. But then I have this second toe, which there's extension of inflammation of the soft tissues, but no direct ulcer. And it has a little bit of subcortical edema, high on T2, but nothing on T1. I would probably say there's a high likelihood of osteomyelitis. But if I see it very far away from the infection, I'd probably say it's a very low likelihood of osteomyelitis. But just try to avoid the term osteitis. You can even say possible early osteomyelitis. I know this is non-conclusive, indeterminate, and in the realm of correlate clinically, but remember that we in radiology always see a representation of the truth, and we have to know our limitations. And I think that the term osteitis is just very out there, non-specific, so it's better for us to say, look, you know, as a radiologist, I think that there is either a low likelihood of osteomyelitis or no, and we come back to the secondary findings. Let's see what is around this infection or this edema to see what is the probability of it being osteomyelitis. So remember, don't use the term osteitis. Use low or high likelihood of osteomyelitis. And lastly, bone biopsies for infection. I do a lot of bone biopsies for infection, even in the foot. It is still to this day the gold standard for evaluation of osteomyelitis. There's a lot of studies out there saying that, well, you know, 50% of the biopsies you do don't grow anything. Some people say 60, 66. I have seen 67%. And it's true, especially in the appendicular skeleton, when you do a bone biopsy of infection, usually it doesn't grow anything or doesn't grow anything that really would change the treatment in antibiotic of the patient. The percentages are much higher in the spine. Discoidal osteomyelitis usually grows something as compared to the appendicular skeleton. But it's still the gold standard. And if you're going to do it, I would say, look, first, is this safe for the patient? If it's safe for the patient, I will go ahead and do it. And second, if the patient has already been in chronic antibiotic, the probability of it growing something in the culture is much less likely. So ideally, you have a patient that comes with an acute or subacute infection, and you do the biopsy, and the patient has not been starting an antibiotics. Once they start antibiotics, the probability of growing something is less. So I still do biopsies for infection. Some people don't want to do it, don't like to do it, but because it's still the gold standard for the infectious disease doctors, I still do it. Hopefully this was helpful, and thank you for listening to my podcast. If you like this podcast, consider following the MSK Radiology Genie in Instagram by the username of MSK Radiology Genie, and also in YouTube. We have a YouTube page with video conferences of MSK Radiology, as well as mentorship and advice for medical students. Thank you.